From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. Coming up in the hour ahead, a discussion about how climate change may already be affecting California. A report released late last week outlines the ways our changing climate is posing not a theoretical challenge to the state, but rather what it calls an immediate and growing threat to California's water, vegetation, and wildlife. And not only is the change upon us, the pace of climate change is dramatic, possibly 10 times faster than any such change in the past 65 million years. We'll talk about recent research findings on the climate and what can be done on the state level to address the issues at hand. Stay with us for the conversation. It's coming your way after this. From KQED in San Francisco, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. The impact of climate change in California is already upon us, and those changes in the climate are happening at the fastest pace since the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. So say research findings released last week by the California's Environmental Protection Agency and earlier this month by scientists at Stanford University. Increased wildfires, rising sea levels along the state's coastline, and the migration of plants and wildlife to higher elevations are all cited as concrete examples of the impact our changing climate is already having right here at home, right now. While the topic of climate change is one we cover from many angles, these recent studies reveal the imminent threats environmental changes pose to our state's environment, people, and economy. This hour on Forum, we look at what the current research findings are and what they say about when and how the changes at hand will affect our state. Also, what can we be doing in the near term, policy-wise, to address the issues? With us for the conversation is Matt Rodriguez. He's the California Secretary for Environmental Protection. Also with us is Dr. Christopher Field. He's the founding director at Carnegie Institution Department of Global Ecology and a Stanford professor, also one of the co-chairs of the Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And also with us this hour is Craig Miller. He's the science editor here at KQED. And Craig, I want to start with you just to take a look at this most recent EPA study that came out last week. You know, we cover climate change from lots of angles a lot of the time, and I'm wondering what in this current EPA study really caught your eye.
You know, this was part of a whole suite of studies and statements and findings that have come out as been an avalanche of this stuff over the last couple of weeks from both the state and federal authorities and scientists. And I think what has really caught my eye about all of it taken together is that the language is becoming more urgent. The governments, when they put out their reports, are no longer talking about climate change in terms of something that we're going to have to deal with. They're talking about it in terms of something that is here now. And so you have the state EPA report called Indicators of Climate Change calling it an immediate and growing threat. Referring to already discernible impacts. You have the federal climate folks, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, declaring 2012 the hottest year on record for the U.S. and one of the top 10 globally, and expressing real concern about the things like loss of Arctic sea ice and ocean acidification, which is happening right now. And you have the American Geophysical Union, an extremely credible organization of Earth scientists, coming out also last week and saying, quote, human-induced climate change requires urgent action. This is almost a sea change, no pun intended, you know, from simple scientific findings to calls for action that we're seeing from more and more scientists.
And this is the state's EPA study, so bring it home to California. So all of those things we've sort of been tracking and following, but this is saying right here, right now in California.
Right. And what it's saying basically is that the climate has been warming overall. It depends. It's patchy. You know, how much and how fast depends on where you are. It's saying that heat waves are on the rise. You mentioned wildfires. That's highly variable from year to year, how much acreage gets burned. But the largest wildfire years, you know, of the last three largest wildfire years since 1950 have all been in the last decade. You have as we know, the oceans are rising. It's up about 8 inches over the last century here in San Francisco, and rising. But there's good. There's some good news in it too. But the problem is, we don't know how long the good news is going to last. One of the findings is that California emissions, for example, of greenhouse gases are actually down a little bit since 2008 by about 7%, as a matter of fact. But a lot of that has to do with the recession. Industrial activity slows down during a recession, and you know, there's concern that a lot of this good news may be transitory. You know, and that it that the global warming is going to catch up with us at some point.
Well, I want to talk Matt Rodriguez with you as the Secretary for Environmental Protection in California. But Mr. Rodriguez, hang on one more minute. I want to hear from Dr. Field about some of the specifics in this EPA study. They refer to indicators of change that are showing impact immediately. Talk a little bit about what these indicators are, the science behind this study, and what the research is showing scientifically.
Penny, I think the real difference between where we were a few years ago and now is that it's not just about abstracts, reading on thermometers, reading of tide gauges. What we're really seeing is concrete evidence of a wide range of impacts. I think of it sort of like each of these impacts is a car and a freight train, and together they really have a lot of momentum. And they concern things like not only temperature and sea level rise, but issues of a profound importance to California, issues with water availability, with risks of flooding, with risks of wildfire, with risks of mortality from heat waves. And the thing that's most important is that these are not projections. These are concrete observations of things that have already changed and are likely to continue to change as we move into the future.
So the indicators are events that we can document, we can gauge, we can watch, we can record, whether it be literal nighttime temperatures and the change in that and how that might affect the agricultural industry, sea level rise. So these are markers that we've been keeping track of for a few years now in the state. Is that right?
That's right. These indicators are all based on direct observations, things that scientists or interested public can go out and measure with their own instruments, and are accumulating evidence of not only the fact that the climate's changing, but the fact that it's already having impacts on California.
All right. That's Dr. Christopher Field. He's a professor at Stanford University and also the director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Energy. Let's turn now to Matt Rodriguez, California's Secretary for Environmental Protection. And I want to ask you kind of the $64,000 question. This study refers to an immediate and growing threat. And I look to you to see what is threatened most immediately.
Well, there are a number of issues that are identified in this report that will be of interest to California and California decision makers. Some of the things that we see in the report have been mentioned by the previous speakers. For example, we need to look at the question of changes in spring runoff and what that will mean to our water allocations and water planning here in the state of California. Additionally, the changes in temperature at night have implications for our agricultural industry, and so we'll have to be talking to the agricultural industry about what these changes might mean and how we might deal with these changes in the future. Additionally, it's clear that we need to be prepared to deal with more extreme heat events, and we also need to be prepared to deal with the prospect of additional wildfires. So there are a number of indicators here that we as decision makers at the state will have to be looking at and trying to figure out how we can develop programs to address these issues in the future.
Now, you were instrumental in defending the state's proposed limits on greenhouse gas emissions when those limits were being challenged by the auto industry. And this report, or at least some of the reports that I've read, indicate that 40% of California's emissions come from transportation and vehicular output. Is that a good place to start?
Oh, clearly that's one of the things we've been working on for quite some time. You know, basically there are three things that we're trying to do just in general to deal with climate change. The first is we're trying to change the fuels that we use in California. because, as you indicated, the transportation sector is one of the main causes of greenhouse gas production. And so we're looking at encouraging the use of alternative fuels and less carbon-intensive fuels. The next thing we're trying to do is we're trying to encourage more energy efficiency, and that's, again, an important area. Frankly, it's one that California has been a leader in since the first Brown administrations in the 70s. In the 70s, the governor was one of the first proponents of energy efficiency and energy efficiency standards. And it's just a question of making sure that when we are using fuel, that we use it efficiently and that we're reducing emissions by using less energy. And then finally, we're looking at, are there ways that we can change our lifestyle patterns and do slightly different planning so that we're capable of using more public transit, we have less vehicle miles traveled than the average day, things that we can do to change our vehicle use patterns.
Well, and all of that, you know, and we've been on the forefront for quite a while with all of that, but it's it can be, as just a Californian, it can be frustrating because we're not an island. We're part of this larger global system, and I'm wondering what we can do individually as a state impact-wise and how much we're at the mercy of other states and other countries' policies.
Well, clearly, global warming and climate change is an international problem. There are a couple of things we can do. We can continue our own programs, and we can ensure that those programs are successful.
And maybe contagious to other states.
Well, that's it. I mean, if we can show that we can continue to grow our economy, and that's an important factor for us to consider as decision makers as well, but if we can demonstrate that we can grow our economy and still achieve our environmental objectives, I think that that sets a good tone for our discussion then with the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And I think that the message that we're sending from California is resonating. We've received contacts from a number of states and countries that are interested in California's program. They want to know how our programs are working, how they're designed. And I find that actually very encouraging. And in my 2 years as Cal EPA Secretary, I've had discussions with representatives from China, Australia, the UK, many discussions with individuals from Canada and Mexico, from the Philippines, and there's just general interest in what we're doing here in California.
So the research also shows that the state is not warming in a uniform fashion, that there's more intense warming going on in the Central Valley and in Southern California, and obviously, the heart of agriculture is affected by that. And I'm wondering, as a policymaker and as somebody who deals with the folks in Sacramento who are creating policy, is that a particular region of resistance to the concept of climate change and tackling the problem? Or because this so immediately impacts their industries, there's less resistance than there might be?
Actually, I've been pleased by the receptivity of the agricultural industry to our discussions of climate change and what we need to do on climate change. I think there's a recognition that we need to be tracking climate change and what it means for California because it is so important to the agricultural industry here.
But is there support? Are you finding that there's support for changes in policy that might be uncomfortable initially?
Well, there's a willingness to discuss changes and a willingness to discuss programs, and I think that that's what's important. And we do have a number of programs, frankly, that are in effect right now that are designed to deal with climate change. So it's a combination of making sure that those programs continue to work and then continuing to have a dialogue with industry to make sure that they're comfortable with the direction we're taking with those programs. And so far, I think we've been successful in meeting both those objectives.
So policy changes, implementing new rules and regulations, and certainly disaster mitigation, preparing parts of the state for the impact of, say, rising sea levels or drought or huge storms, you know, that costs money. So in a state that is tight right now with money, and taxpayers really resisting seeing the tax rates go up. Where's the money going to come from? It's going to cost billions of dollars.
Well, we've got to identify where the problems are first, and we're working. We have at the administration level, we have a climate action team that brings together all the agencies in the state so that we can trade information and talk about both climate change and what we need to be doing to be ready to deal with climate change issues. Part of that dialogue involves looking at funding and funding sources, what's available right now, where are we going to need additional funds in the future. So at this point, really, it's a question of, and that's why this report is so important, it gives us some indication of where we need to be focusing our time, our resources, and our efforts. And so that's what we've been doing right now.
What's the vibe with lawmakers in Sacramento? Are you getting the sense that the purse strings might be loosening for money to address these issues?
I'm always loath to get out ahead of the legislators and the folks who control the purse strings, but I will say that I think we've worked very well with the legislature over the last couple of years. There was some legislation that went through last year that dealt with how we would use funds that are being generated by our cap and trade program, and would focus those funds to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while at the same time we think helping our economy. I think that the legislators also understand that by being on the forefront of environmental programs, we're creating jobs here in California. So, for example, our solar power industry has developed over 44,000 jobs, and we have the biggest program in the country. So I think there's an understanding there. We've continued to work with the legislature. So, for example, they passed legislation that allowed us to start down a pathway to linking our cap-and-trade program with the program of Quebec and hopefully other states and provinces in the future. So there's been a definite willingness to work with us to deal with some of these programs and continue to work on these programs in the future.
Chris Field, I want to ask you, as somebody who's intimately connected with the research and what's happening in the state, what would you want from policymakers in Sacramento that you think would most directly impact or positively impact the climate change that's going on? What would help?
Well, politics always has its own dynamic. I did want to add one element to your question to Matt about the cost. You know, not doing anything about climate change costs a lot as well. And when we talk about preparation, what we're really talking about in most cases is spending something now in order to avoid much larger expenditures in the future. And the same is true when we talk about minimizing the amount of climate change that occurs in the future, mitigating future climate change. What we're really trying to figure out is how can we make investments now that transition us to a energy system that's not polluting the atmosphere in a way to reduce the long-term damages that occur as a consequence of that pollution. I think the thing that's a really critical part of the discussion that everyone needs to remember is that there are real costs associated with using the atmosphere as a waste dump. That's what we've been doing for many decades. And until we recognize that investments now are investments in avoiding these much larger long-term costs, it's going to be hard to get the pieces lined up correctly.
Craig?
Well, Chris says that politics has its own dynamic. One piece of the dynamic, again, within the last couple of weeks, a major poll from the Public Policy Institute of California, something that jumped out at me from that was that a fairly astounding 82% of Californians now say they favor passing regulations and spending money in order to prepare for the future effects of climate change. But of course, the devil is always in the details.
Well, but that was and that was also, if I can jump in, that was a really dramatic jump from even 1 year before. Is that right? I mean, the numbers showed a big hike from even 2012.
The jump was in a more general question, which was do you think it's a serious threat and we should be doing something about it right now? But interestingly enough, though, while a significant portion of Californians support measures like pushing utilities toward more renewable power. You know, we have this 33% renewable standard by 2020 that's going into effect. A lot of that support evaporates when you say, well, what if it raised your electric bill? And then you hear people say, not so much.
Rodriguez, what do you say about that? If the constituents in theory are behind the idea of getting ahead of this and managing it, and as Chris Field says, you know, spending some now so that we don't have to spend it later, how do you, in policy terms in state governance, bring the constituents along to pay it up?
Well, we have to make sure that they understand the programs and that they understand that the programs are working. I think there's much more of a willingness to invest in the programs if you're seeing results. And part of that also requires that we reach out to businesses and look at the economic impacts of our regulations and assure everybody that we're considering the economic impacts of our regulations as our programs are being developed and implemented. As I said, one of the things that I've been discussing recently is the fact that we've been able to do these programs while California's economy has turned around and it's really improving right now. So we see a prospect for jobs. We see a prospect for economic prosperity here at the same time that we are launching some very ambitious programs, frankly, to deal with climate change
and environmental problems. Like what? Beyond the fuel, beyond what you mentioned around fuel and transportation, what are some of the other programs?
Well, the cap and trade program, is an ambitious program. It's starting a market to put a price on carbon, and that's a very significant program.
Are there other ones that are in the works that the public may not know about quite yet?
It's really a point of fine-tuning and implementing some of the programs that we've been developing over the last couple of years. So, for example, there's going to be continued discussion of the low-carbon fuel standard that has been embraced by the ARB, which is a program to try and reduce the carbon content of fuels by 10%. We're looking at what we can do to encourage further use and interest in zero-emission vehicles, for example, since, as you noted, transportation is a big part of our problem here in California.
Let me jump in real quick. We only have less than 2 minutes, but I know Craig Miller wants to ask something of you.
And that's always when we open a can of worms, when there's 2 minutes left. But, Matt, if the evidence is so compelling that all of this can be done without harming the economy, why is California still substantially going it alone? By this time, we were supposed to have several other states with us in the so-called Western Climate Initiative linking up to our cap-and-trade program. They're not following. What's going on?
Well, I think there was an economic downturn several years ago. I think folks are still skittish about that. And I think, frankly, people are waiting to see whether we can achieve our objectives of dealing with environmental issues while maintaining our economy. So people are still watching us, but I will say that there's been more interest in our programs of late. There's been more outreach of late. And so I'm looking for more collaboration with other states in the future.
All right, and we can address that. We're going to take a short break. We'll hit more on that topic when we come back. We're talking about the fast pace of climate change and how it's already affecting California. If you'd like to join in the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Penny Nelson, and you're listening to KQED. KQED Public Radio. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny, and we're discussing research findings released late last week from the California Environmental Protection Agency and study results from Stanford that were released earlier in the month, alerting us to the reality that climate change is rapidly upon us and already posing a threat to the state's water, environment, and wildlife. And we're discussing scientists' findings about what the state is doing, could be doing, should be doing policy-wise to address these effects. We were just speaking with Matt Rodriguez, who is the California Secretary for Environmental Protection, and talking a lot about kind of policies that are in place or might be in place, should be in place to address the immediate and growing threat that is cited in the EPA study. Also with us for the hour is Dr. Christopher Field. He's a Stanford professor and founding director at Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology, and is also co-chair of one of the working groups of the Intergovernmental Environmental Panel on Climate Change, and also joined this hour by KQED's science editor, Craig Miller. And Craig, right before the break, you asked of Matt Rodriguez a pretty pointed question. I'd like to hear your follow-up response to his response.
So I was asking him why so few other states and provinces and regions tend to be following California's lead, especially on the cap and trade front, when by now we were supposed to have a lot of company in this so-called Western Climate Initiative. And I think he's right.
And is that the idea? We were supposed by now to have
to have half a dozen states along with us, and four Canadian provinces were in on this, and we were all going to be capping and trading together and linking up the markets, and it was going to be one big happy family. And I think the Secretary's response was right. I mean, you know, we were on our way down this happy trail when the economy tanked, and suddenly virtually everybody else said, wait a minute, why should we stick our necks out? Let's let California walk on the bleeding edge and see how it goes for them. Once they see that this can be done, you know, without, you know, severe damage to the economy, which is the presumption at this point, it's not proven, then I think probably other people will follow.
Well, and it's interesting because with the economy and the wrestling match we've been having with our economy, and then campaigns like that was started by Rick Perry in Texas that almost are campaigning against regulation that might be helping the environment. We're kind of fighting an uphill battle at this very time, being told that your businesses in California, if you're feeling too regulated, head on over to our state because we're free and easy and we'll let you do anything you want. You know, that makes it a pretty tough sell here in California.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an uphill battle against perception on many fronts, even up to and including, you know, what's causing climate change and to what extent it's really happening. It's a good thing we have Chris Field here to talk about that. And the thing that's missing, too, from a lot of these government reports that have come out lately is they like to stay away from making projections. They're talking now about things we're observing, but they're a little bit, you know, they're a little bit ginchy about going out on a ledge and saying, here's what we think is coming. And again, I think Dr. Field can address that.
Well, Dr. Field, let's go to you. You say that climate change will be the issue of the 21st century. And your recent Stanford study, the one that came out on August 1st, makes note of the extraordinary pace that the change is happening at.
That's right, Penny. We know that the Earth has gone through climate changes in the past, and a series of ice ages over the last several million years. There was a huge event 55 million years ago where the Earth warmed by about as much as we think it might warm in this century. But the thing that separates what's happening now from what's happened in the past is that the pace of the current changes is exceedingly rapid. It's more rapid by at least a factor of 10 than any past climate changes the Earth has experienced, any of the large climate changes the Earth has experienced. And what that means for humans and ecosystems is really quite dramatic. Already, if you think about a plant or an animal that should be trying to stay in a zone of constant climate, in many parts of the world, those plants and animals would be needing to move by about half a mile per year toward cooler parts of their range. And if you're a mountain lion or a deer, that's not too challenging. But if you're a redwood tree or a slug, a half a mile per year is a really rapid pace.
Sure, and it's something that in past changes of the climate, the species have been given thousands of years to adapt, adjust, migrate, move, and you're talking decades. They're forced into doing transitions, adaptations within decades.
That's exactly right. Thousands of years as opposed to years. And in addition, you know, we really live in a Earth system now that I call the Anthropocene. It's dominated by humans. And in the past, as plants or animals tried to move to cooler parts of their habitat, they just went through natural environment. But now there's freeways and agricultural fields and suburbs and everything else that are chopping up the natural world so that it's little pockets of nature in this huge matrix of human activity.
So what you call human stressors. So we've got the habitat destruction, we've got pollution, we've got human encroachment, and we've got this expedited need for species to adapt, plant and animal species to adapt. Kind of doesn't seem very plausible.
Well, you know, there are profound challenges, challenges for humans as well as for natural ecosystems. And I think that there are two really important things that could be done. One is to prepare as well as possible for the climate changes that can't be avoided, the adaptation agenda. Matt spoke to some of that already, and there are a lot of opportunities. And the other is mitigation, making sure that climate doesn't change any more than is absolutely necessary, reducing the amount of climate change that occurs as a result of deploying efforts to decrease the release of heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere.
All right, we're going to go to calls, but before we do, in just 1 minute, one more question for you, Dr. Field. Do you think – so my guess is that we can't reverse the trend, but to what extent can we stem the tide?
There's an awful lot that can be done, and I think that California has a very important leadership role. I hope it's a leadership role that will be adopted by others as its success proves itself. But essentially now we are committed to an amount of climate change that is substantial, consequential. But beyond that, beyond 2030, 2040, the amount of climate change that occurs really is going to be a consequence of what kind of policy decisions are made not only in California and the United States but around the world. And we really do have the opportunity to have a late 21st century that's substantially altered from the present or dramatically altered from the present. And that's really the policy choice we face.
Craig Miller?
You used to hear, it seems, more about this than we have lately, but this idea of the tipping point, that at some point we reach a point in the global warming scenario where beyond which, you know, there are catastrophic, chaotic consequences that could eventually, you know, render the planet uninhabitable or mean major consequences for the human race as well as other species. How close are we to that, do you think?
I would say that in the scientific community, we have transitioned from thinking about one or a small number of global tipping points to discussing climate change as a problem in risk management. And if you were in New Jersey in last year when Hurricane Sandy came, you know, those were disastrous consequences already. And I think what we're seeing is that the impacts of climate change that are being felt are very consequential where they're being felt, but the pervasiveness is what is still limited by the fact that the climate changes haven't advanced that far. It is also the case that in the future there are real risks of very substantial consequences from climate change. A loss of the Greenland ice sheet with approximately 23 feet of sea level equivalent is the one that's discussed most frequently. And the fact of the matter is we don't exactly know what level of global warming is going to be sufficient in order to commit us irreversibly to loss of the Greenland ice sheet. Most of the model estimates have that occurring somewhere between 2 and 4 Fahrenheit warming above pre-industrial. We're almost 2 already, and so that kind of risk is very real, and it's one that deserves a serious place in this risk management discussion.
And boy, you don't want we're at the tipping point. There we are. There we are. That's the point of the tipping point.
I'll give
that's
you another example
Field
of that, if I can. Is that sorry for to jump in here, but when I first started covering this beat, you know, maybe serious manner, maybe 8 years ago or so, you know, the scientists said that the sea level rise, the majority of the sea level rise, was being caused by simple thermal expansion of the water molecules. You know, water heats up, it gets bigger, and that there was an additional contribution of the ice melting from the poles. Now I'm hearing that it's flipped, that the actual the melting of Arctic ice is actually a bigger contributor to sea level rise at this point than.
Well, clearly we're in new territory because we don't know where the tipping point is. We don't exactly know the science behind a lot of this. We're finding it out as we go. Let's go to some of our calls. We've got John calling us from Alameda. Good morning.
Good morning. So I think it was about 10 years ago, the IPCC made a series of predictions that were, I guess this year found out to be wildly conservative. I mean, the parts per million of carbon, for example, global warming, temperature rises in the oceans, geographical ranges and changes in species, et cetera, was found to be far too conservative. I'm just wondering, what were the takeaways, you know, from that experience, and were those lessons learned incorporated into these new numbers that we're seeing from Stanford and Cal EPA, and understanding, you know, where climate change might be leading us?
Chris Field?
John raises a really important point, which is that neither in the IPCC nor anyplace else do we really have the ability to predict the future. We don't know what human decisions are going to be in the future. We don't know what kind of government policies are going to be in place. So in the scientific community, what we try and do is play out the consequences of different possible futures, a range of possible futures. And one of the things that has been surprising to me and a lot of people in the research community is that over the last 20 years, emissions of heat-trapping gases and the pace of climate change have tended to track right along the trajectory of the most rapid scenarios that we've explored. And I think that we have tended to operate in an environment where we said, well, you know, a range of things may happen in the future. But as we see the really rapid growth in rapidly industrializing parts of the world, I think we have an appreciation that the range of possible outcomes includes some with very, very dramatic amounts of warming. And those will be expressed in the forthcoming IPCC reports, recognizing that the role of the scientific community is not to predict the future, but it's to explore the consequences of alternative possible futures.
Well, and hopefully it's the role of the policymakers, legislators, and public to be reading that, knowing it, learning about it, and reacting appropriately.
Exactly right.
We have a bunch of email responses coming in. One listener writes, California cannot solve climate change by itself. In fact, the world may very likely continue forward as is, with only minor blunting of the pace of CO2 emissions when the developing countries are factored in. We need to spend more of our energy on adaptation. Another listener writes, why do we all drive around in multi-ton vehicles, often with no passengers and little cargo, citing the problem with SUVs that Bay Area people drive around in. Yet another listener writes in, one key thing Governor Jerry Brown could do about climate change today in California is prohibit fracking. Fracking is poised to dramatically expand our state, opening up the 15.5 billion barrels of dirty oil in the Monterey Shale to extraction and combustion. And then an interesting question that a writer is going to raise with us, and I'd like you both, Craig and Chris, to address. He's saying, what's new here? I thought you'd be discussing concrete things, something real. Instead, you're rehashing the same old stuff, and we need to have some specifics.
Well, there is some interesting detail in the report and some surprising detail. You know, one item, for example, you know, that heat waves are increasing in some surprising places, like in the northern coastal regions of California.
Mendocino, right?
Yeah. Now, what passes for a heat wave in Mendocino isn't exactly what passes in Barstow, but still.
But for the local flora and fauna, it sure is.
That's right. And if you look at the water situation, for example, and the Sacramento River, which is the aorta, you know, of California's water system, and just the spring runoff in that system, we're talking about just that key part of the season. You know, when you have the snow melt going on, it's all coming down from the Sierra. That spring runoff over the past century is already down by 9%. These are some pretty specific findings that, you know, we weren't seeing in a lot of previous reports.
And that I thought this was so interesting. Overnight chill temperatures, the overnight low temperatures are increasing at twice the rate of other
nearly
temperatures.
Twice the
is
rate.
That right?
Yeah,
and that would have a huge impact on a large part of our agricultural industry.
And we just did a documentary on that point exactly, which you can watch online, called Heat and Harvest, where we did talk about already observed effects on crops, particularly stone fruits, cherries, and things like that, that need this chilling time, you know, in order to properly produce fruit. They're already being affected. Yeah.
And I should mention that you can find a link to the California EPA report on our website at kqed.org/forum. So if you want to take a look at all those details yourself, you can do that. Let's go back to the calls. We've got Catherine calling us from Sacramento. Good morning,
yes,
Catherine.
Good morning. Thank you, Penny, for having this program. Our United Nations Association Sacramento chapter is on record as supporting a carbon fee. And that would be a fee and dividend. The dividend would go back to each citizen. Therefore, it would not be a substantial expense to each person. We need this in transportation. We're having a program on September 16th at our municipal utility district, specifically on the need for a carbon tax. We'll have a panel of about four speakers.
All right,
welcome anybody that's there. to okay. plug in or come.
Great. Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for that. And let's go now to Linda calling from Napa.
Hi. I'm calling with a couple of thoughts. One is a question about the degree to which short-lived climate forcers, such as black carbon, are incorporated into the state's thinking at this point about its own activities. I bring this up because all of the climate metrics that are used today are based on the basic Kyoto list of climate forces. That would be the standard greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, and methane, and a few other classifications. But the short-lived pollutants, such as black carbon, which go up, they live in the environment for just a short time and come down, have been found to have effects that are thousands of times more potent as greenhouse gases.
All right, let's hear from Dr. Christopher Field on that.
It's a really good question, and it's one that should be an increasing part of the debate. Currently, about two-thirds of the total climate forcing comes from carbon dioxide, and about a third comes from methane, nitrous oxide, and black carbon, other short-lived compounds. A lot of the reason that the long-term focus has been on carbon dioxide is because it's the most important greenhouse gas, but a lot of the reason is that it's the one that is most deeply integrated into the operations of the energy system. If we want to decrease emissions of carbon dioxide, we basically need to come up with a new source of energy. There are real opportunities in dealing with black carbon and other short-lived climate forcers, and they should be a part of the broad discussion. One of the things that has tended to happen with economic development is that these short-lived climate forcers have tended to be addressed primarily through efforts to address air pollution, and they have tended to sort of go along for the addressing decreases in emissions of these have gone along for the ride. I think that they should be a front and center part of future discussions, not that they should overwhelm the discussion about reducing CO2, which is really the long-term problem, but they should be an important part of the short-term discussions.
Thanks for the question. We have an emailer, Ron, asking, isn't it possible that the increases in wildfires are the result of environmentalist work in banning the maintenance and thinning of forests in California? And this is a refrain we hear quite a lot, so I want to raise it, that it is environmentalist actions that are causing all these wildfires.
Most of the environmental challenges we face have a number of different causal factors. In California, we have a long history of experience with wildfires. We know that Santa Ana winds are a critical contributor to wildfires. We know that previous fire management efforts at suppression can play a role. We also know that things that homeowners do on a short-term basis play a big role in how at risk their properties are. Are their houses built in fire-prone areas? Are there fire-defensible zones? And we also know that things like infrastructure for getting fire crews in and for getting residents out of area can play a big role in how much damage is incurred. With most of the environmental problems we face, there are numerous factors that are contributing to the causes, and there are numerous opportunities for decreasing the risk moving forward.
All right. I want to talk about fracking, and I think we have a caller who is right on target with that. Do I have Patrick on the line? Patrick, are you with us?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. I'm calling because I have always regarded California as kind of a leader in environmental activity and concern about the environment. And I recently read an article about the Monterey Shale Project. And I'm just kind of surprised that California would allow this to let oil companies start marching through California like they have all around the country, and especially with what I read about the tightness of the rock below and how they have to use added pressure and acids and all these things that to extract this oil out and along probably some fault lines. And I just wondered if your guests would address that.
Craig Miller, this, and we've gotten a lot of questions about fracking and shale and what's going on with all this.
And he's talking about a huge potential play called the Monterey Shale, which is partly in Monterey County, but actually encompasses a much bigger area than that. Some people are saying this is the next big play for shale oil, not shale gas. A lot of the fracking that you hear about around the country is
and shale,
in search of
we're
gas.
Saying shale, S-H-A-L-E.
That's right. That's right. It's a type of rock formation,
shell,
you know,
right?
down there. Governor Brown is faced with the same conundrum as Governor Cuomo in New York. And he's basically taking the same page out of his playbook, which is he's hedging his bets. On the one hand, he's saying, you know, this could be a tremendous boon for California and a great opportunity to use a transition fuel. I mean, it is cleaner than coal. Okay?
Yeah, but apparently we don't have that much time.
Yeah, right. That's right. On the other hand, we got to be really careful about it. And yet, it seems to me there's been a tremendous amount of pressure to water down the bills that have been introduced in Sacramento that would force this issue to be studied safeguards to be put in place.
Chris Field, what do you look at fracking as far as the impact on climate change?
Where we are with the global energy system is that we will need to continue to utilize fossil energy resources for a few decades moving into the future. And the challenge we face is figuring out which fossil resources can be used most efficiently and with the least impact to the climate system. In many cases, natural gas is a very attractive alternative to coal. Natural gas has only about half the CO2 emissions per a unit of energy that's produced as coal. But we also need to recognize that low prices on natural gas have been a disincentive to renewables coming into the energy system. What we really need to be positioning ourselves for is transitioning over the 2040 to 2070 period to an environment where we're completely independent of fossil fuels that are emitting CO2 to the atmosphere.
Well, and springboard off of that and talk about the ways in which there's actually a huge opportunity here. We have the potential for a new economic base, new research, new energy, innovation. If people would grab hold of this, what might
right.
we be doing?
Well, absolutely. I see creating the energy system of the 21st century is really the biggest opportunity that we face. There are opportunities, as Matt already discussed, in the area of efficiency, but there are also opportunities in creating the non-emitting energy sources, whether they're based on solar or wind or fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage. There are key places of the technology in place. California already gets a lot of its energy from renewables, but there are key parts that aren't in place. How do we provide energy that's available when we need it and not just when the sun shines or when the wind blows? How do we ensure that we don't have unacceptable losses during transmission? And how do we address the environmental issues that certainly will come up as we look at widespread deployment of a renewable energy system?
But how do we do that? Because even I remember President Obama talking about the new economy mm-hmm. and new energy, and there's so much promise.
All of the above strategy.
It's all of the above. And yet we keep talking about the how do, and if not here in California, then where? So what might we be doing?
Well, I think there are a lot of things to do. The most important are to create a level playing field so that the innovation spirit that's grounded in California can really be successful. And I think that the level playing field has two big components. One is removing subsidies for fossil energy resources, which are still pervasive through the economy. And the second is to, as a previous caller said, somehow get a price on the damage that's being caused by the pollution we're releasing to the atmosphere. And once we have that price signal, it has the potential to unleash the innovation that will create the new energy system.
Well, and of course, the entrepreneurial, innovative, capitalistic California spirit might see huge monetary gain should you be the one that comes up with the magic bullet. Not that there would be one. But we only have a couple minutes left, and I really want to address a question that we've gotten a couple of emails about as well, which cites population as one of the major problems. And we always skirt around this. We talk about climate change, but human population is a huge factor in what's driving all this. Not that I'm asking for any answers.
You're right. Nobody wants to talk about it, but it's true.
Population is a huge factor, but if we look out over the next several decades, we see the possibility that human population might increase anywhere from 30 to maybe 50%. But we see the possibility that overall consumption, that wealth will double, quadruple, and that's where we have the real opportunity to make a difference. In the longer run, population is an issue. In the shorter run, it's dealing with consumption and satisfying the legitimate aspirations of the world's poor people to be wealthier.
All right. Well, that closes us out. That's Dr. Christopher Field. He's the founding director at Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology, a professor at Stanford University, and also one of the leaders in studying climate change and the impact governmentally. Also with us this hour has been Craig Miller, and he is the science editor here at KQED. And we spoke earlier in the hour with Matt Rodriguez, the California Secretary for Environmental Protection. And once again, you can find a link to the Cal EPA report on our website at kqed.org/forum. Thanks to all of you who called into the show and wrote in. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, a conversation with journalist and author Katie Hafner about being right smack in the middle of the sandwich generation, living with her mother and her teenage daughter. Forum's producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. The senior editor is Dan Zoll. Raul Ramirez is the executive producer. And our engineer this hour is Dan Bringer. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.